We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine on Illinois Public Media. You'll find us here at AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In the first half of the 20th century, the number of American rural and farm families declined by one-third. This afternoon, we'll explore what this shift meant to the women who lived through it and remained on the farm in a time of great upheaval and change, years that included two world wars and the Great Depression. Our guest is Amy Mattson-Lauder. She's the author of More Than a Farmer's Wife, Voices of American Farm Women, 1910 to 1960. Lauder's scholarly interest in farm women began when she was a student at the University of Minnesota and was fueled by memories of her paternal grandparents and their farm in northern Wisconsin. It wasn't long before she realized that farm women, in her words, were the backbone of the family business, the managers of the farm home, and the primary contributors to farm publications. City dwellers, she says, had quite a different idea of farm women, though, often seeing them as victims of hard work and poverty. Our guest, Amy Mattson-Lauder, is assistant professor of mass communication at Minnesota State University, Mankato. In addition to More Than a Farmer's Wife, she is the editor of the rediscovered writings of Rose Wilder Lane. Lane was the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Both books are published by the University of Missouri Press. Amy Lauder, it's good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Would you share with us the memory you have of your grandmother on the farm that you shared with your dad at a family reunion and that serves as the opening for this book?
Well, certainly. My earliest memory is actually sitting in a high chair in the big kitchen at my grandparents' farmhouse in northern Wisconsin. I was watching fish out of the corner of my eye. My grandmother liked tropical fish. And she was pulling out a huge roaster full of ham and cheese sandwiches, the foil-wrapped kind. And the whole table was just laden with pots and pans of different casseroles and foods. And it was bustling. There were people running in and out of the kitchen all day. And I apparently was sitting in the high chair just to keep out from underfoot. And when I shared that memory with my father at a reunion, he realized what I was remembering was the day that they sold the farm at auction in the early 1970s. It was I was about a year old, maybe. But it made a really big impression on me.
Yeah. Since that reunion in 2005, what have you learned about your grandmother's life as a farm woman?
Oh, I was fortunate to have been able to talk to her while she was still living a little bit about her time on the farm, and I wish I'd had more time with her. Mm. One of the things that I learned was that she never cooked on a gas or electric stove until about the 60s. She was still working with a wood stove in her kitchen, which is really time-consuming and intensive. I have also learned that she was a chickens person. She managed the chickens on the farm. That was a job that a lot of farm women held, actually. And I also learned afterwards that she was sort of the money manager. My grandfather, in addition to being a farmer, was an auctioneer, and he held accounts at different banks for which he was an auctioneer, and she was the one who kept track of where the money was in their marriage and in their business. And she also raised six sons on that farm in northern Wisconsin.
What had her life been like as a girl?
She was also a farmer's daughter. She grew up, she was born, rather, in Page, North Dakota. And she was one of 13 children on a homestead in North Dakota. And they took what they called taking the back trail. They went east to Wisconsin when she was small, when she was 7 or 8. And they had a farm. Her family had a farm in northern Wisconsin, too. But being one of the youngest girls, all of her older sisters took a lot of those farm tasks from her. When she took her over her farm at 16, she didn't know how to cook. And she told me just before she passed away that her first Christmas present from my grandfather was a cookbook. And I, in my kind of snide way, said, you know, oh, that must have gone over well, sort of sarcastically. And she said, oh, actually, it was the best present I ever got. She had a baby on the way that first Christmas, and she didn't know how to cook, and she was just struggling. And Grandpa got her a cookbook, and she turned out to be an amazing cook. Yeah. One of the things she did in her twilight years was she actually catered weddings and baked cakes. It was amazing.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of variety there in her life.
Well, to be a multitasker, to be a farm woman, I think.
Yeah. Is there still family on a farm or farms in your family?
One of my uncles had a small farm. His widow still lives on the farm. They don't do much with it, but they have the land. And unfortunately, that's the only relative I can think of who even has a farm on that paternal side of the family.
Yeah. I would imagine that that's a common story.
It is. It is a common story. And one of the things that happened here in the early part of the 20th century is conditions on farms changed dramatically with the increase in things like tractors and electricity. We no longer needed so much manpower on the farms to run them. And that freed up a lot of people to move to the city if they wanted to. Also, there was a great deal of movement during the 1930s when the Great Depression sort of kicked several people off of their farms, especially if they were tenants or migrant farmers and they didn't own their land. There wasn't work to be found, so they migrated into the cities too. But farms also have traditionally been a lot of work, and I know in my own family the reason none of my uncles or my father took over that farm, why they had to auction it when my grandfather grew too weak to maintain it, none of them wanted to work. None of them wanted to work as hard as farmers did. They didn't want that responsibility.
Hmm. What's the story today on the farm? Do we continue to see people migrate away from that way of life?
That's an excellent question, actually. There tends to be more corporate farming today than there was even in 1960. Corporations were taking over the farms. Families were going into the city if they wanted to. Those who have clung to their farms and their land and their way of life, they're diehards. They want to be on the farms. And there was a movement in the 70s that's even continued to now of people who've gone to the city and have decided that's not where they wanted to be, and they go back to the farms. The co-ops and organic farming and organic produce and this sort of movement now is really making the farm kind of a comeback story in some respects. But it's a little early to tell whether that's going to stick.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to look back on this period and look at farm women anew, you know, farm women in the year, in the first decade of the 20th century.
Yes, it will.
You received a letter from an Indiana woman by the name of Dorothy Wilma Jones Kennard about her mother during the course of doing your research, her mother, Pearl Smith Jones. And maybe here you would share it with us, and we'll go back in time to the farm women of the period that you cover in this book, More Than a Farmer's Wife. Would you read it for us, please?
Oh, certainly. My mother was born May 2nd, 1891, and died April 6th, 1993. She had married 6 years when my father died during the flu epidemic in 1919. They had just bought a 160-acre farm on which they lived and had a boy, Earl, age 4, and a boy, Carol, age 2, and me, Wilma, one day old. She had just gone to the 8th grade and was given a choice, piano lessons or high school, and she chose the piano lessons. She was from a family of 11 children on a farm, so she knew nothing else but to stay on the farm. Back then, there was no help, and the court took over after her husband died and put us up for adoption. only through the heart of the judge in Anderson. He said he was going to give this woman a chance and would personally take responsibility for her. That was the only way she got to keep us. Well, she continued to work harder than any man and every year reported to his office. She raised chickens, milked cows, had sheep, hogs. She would start milking at 3 a.m. and when we got home from school, would be milking. We ate what we raised, had no money to buy much, did buy sugar, spices, crackers, baked our bread, ground our flour. We lived on a creek, and when we needed something for a meal, she would say, "Go to the creek and bring us a fish." Our grandmother helped me pick the ducks for the feather beds. We all three graduated from high school, but there was no funds for higher education. When I was 21, I was working in an office in Anderson. Mom and I went to the judge's office, and he released her and bragged on her with tears in both their eyes. And for all those years of supervising, he didn't charge her a cent. She continued to live on the farm until she was 97, although she stopped driving at 90.
That is a letter from Dorothy Wilma Jones Kennard of Pendleton, Indiana, that wrote our guest Amy Mattson Lauders on July 2nd of 2007 regarding her mother, Pearl Smith Jones, who was born May 2nd, 1891. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. We welcome your phone calls, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The story that's laid out here in this letter, is it typical for farm women? That is the story of hard work.
That is typical. One of the things that comes through in all of the research that I conducted, all of the magazines I read, all of the women that I talked to, was that farm life meant hard work. There's almost an equality there. We think of the farm, we think of hard work. That's simply the bottom line. That's a very typical story. Farm women were up early. They often were in charge of the gardens and the chickens and the children and the produce. They were the principal food distribution system. They were the people who gathered the food from the land, who created it, preserved it, cooked it, served it. That was the primary job. But secondarily to that, they would help out in the fields when necessary. They would help out with the milking of the cows when necessary. Sometimes they took that over. And in many cases, when the farm wasn't self-sustaining, the farm wife would be the one who went to town and took another job. On top of that, the hard work was just part of their everyday lives.
Yeah. Now, for your research, you interviewed more than 180 women.
Yes.
What did they tell you about how they felt about their lives on the farm?
That widely varied. There is a tendency in some places to look back with nostalgia, sort of this rose-colored glasses. Everything was better on the farm. Even as they're describing hard work, they're also describing a way of life that they really miss, one that's family-centered, one where the family was a unit, one that they perceive as being lacking in today's society. And then there is another contingent of women who were very careful to explain to me that the hard work was the reason they, in turn, did leave the farm. So I talked to women who stayed on the farms, and I talked to women who were raised on farms and left. And there's a pretty big difference between the perceptions of these two groups of women. The women who left the farms did so because they wanted better educational opportunities for themselves, and they wanted to avoid the hard work that they perceived their mothers as being victimized by. And the women who stayed on the farms would not have left for anything. They loved it. They loved what they did in the end.
Yeah. Later in the interview, we'll talk more about the role of mass media in the lives of farm families and farm women in the public arena. But here I'd like to share an excerpt, you include in the book from Good Housekeeping magazine, written in 1940 by Eleanor Roosevelt. Before I do that, would you like to provide a little context for what I'm going to share?
Certainly. Eleanor Roosevelt, as many of us know, was the wife of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and She was also a woman who was a writer. She wrote a great deal for women's magazines. And in 1940, she was talking about women in particular, particularly women in politics. And this excerpt is from Good Housekeeping magazine, in which she was trying to persuade women to take their roles in politics.
And here it is. The farmer's wife, for instance, must get into her day more work than does the average businessman. Many a woman runs the family home on a slender pay envelope by planning her budget and doing her buying along lines that would make many a failing business succeed. It will always take all kinds of women to make up a world, and only now and then will they unite their interests. When they do, I think it is safe to say that something historically important will happen. Here we have, as you point out, a recognition of diversity among women, and also a little piece of writing here that addresses farm women as individuals with unique needs that don't always correspond to the needs and interests of women in the city. Would you talk more about that?
Well, there's a big difference between how farm women manage and how city women manage. And this is touched on over and over again in all of the research that I've read. And my other interest is Laura Ingalls Wilder, and she's written about this too. Farm women, because of the very nature of their lives and their business, they're business women. They manage a business. They have to stretch their funds to work within a family unit. That is, every penny that comes into the farm has to go out in such a way as to make sure all of the children are fed and clothed and the business is also sustained. That means there's very little cash on hand normally because the farm itself provides all of the food and most of the clothing that is necessary to sustain the family. On the other hand, city women, they don't have the farm. They don't have the readily available food. For example, they don't have chickens and goats and cows, and they don't keep a wheat field in their backyard. They don't maintain the acreage of garden truck and produce that farm women do. So they rely on that weekly paycheck that comes in, and they have to stretch that and budget that money very specifically. So it's just a difference in economy, among other things. And just an acknowledgement here, too, that farm women really were businesswomen in a way that many city women at the time were not.
At the time. That's an important distinction. I've got a listener here who wants to join a conversation, but I have one more question here to follow up on. What is it that most significantly divides rural and urban culture today, given that we've seen sort of a leveling of women's status in the world, urban and rural?
That is an excellent question. It's one that a lot of scholars have really struggled with. Once we recognize the diversity between urban women and rural women, we start to recognize that there's a value system that's a bit different. Rural women really have an independence of thought that they would argue is traditional and yet feminist. and yet they would refuse to call themselves feminists. And urban women have a tendency, as I said, to see rural women as being sort of victimized. They don't necessarily recognize that this is a business and that's run in a way where the women are in charge. But there's a lot more to it than that, and we're still exploring the diversity in this population. I don't think that we've quite gotten to the place yet in our own women's studies to really be able to articulate precisely what the differences may be.
Amy Mattson-Lauders is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of More Than a Farmer's Wife, Voices of American Farm Women, 1910 to 1960. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon joins us on line one, from Fisher, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Yes. I know women throughout the last several decades that did all that. Now, going forward, how do you think society is going to cope with, the situation that we're in now? And
meaning economic situation or?
The economic situation, you know, people have forced back into the urban environment. What do you think will happen? And I'll just listen.
Okay.
Wow, that is a really big question. We are really in a period of turmoil at this point. Economically, we have a lot of families struggling in a way that many have compared to the Great Depression. And I can see when I look, just as a comparison, at all of the writing in the Great Depression and all of the people I talked to who lived through that era, nobody knew what the outcome was going to be. No one knew what the future would hold. They were really just looking from day to day as a way to survive from day to day, this one day at a time kind of mentality. And it's only really looking back that they're able to tell us much about that period and where we came from. But it was a decisive, divisive moment in our cultural history that really changed a lot. It took people away from an agrarian lifestyle, put them into the cities. Now, today, we're in the same kind of situation. We've got some really deep, troubling problems that we're trying to address as a nation. But, again, I don't think we're going to be able to see exactly where we're going until we get through it. We just need to pick a direction.
Yeah. I don't know if you'd feel comfortable, if you can say anything about this, but there's some inkling. It seems to me, I don't know where I'm picking this up, but it seems to me that we're talking about a crisis on the farm that we most recently saw in the early 1980s. What do you think?
Yes. There has been, farming has been in crisis for some time. And a lot of that has to do with the inability for the small farmer to really make a profit and manage in the face of larger corporate structures. There's a lot more corporate farming today than there was even 50 years ago, even 10 years ago. Corporations buy up the farms, and they farm them with all of those mechanization tools that are available that have just come along in the 20th century, and that's slowly crowding the small farmers out of business. So the only way to really succeed as a farmer and make a profit at it is to hold a great deal of land and to manage it well and or to have a small farm that you simply plan to use as a self-sustaining farm, something that is meant to provide your family with meat and cheese and vegetables and whatever it is you need for your basics. And I sort of think we might see more of that. Just anecdotally, I've been hearing a lot of conversation. I live in rural Minnesota. A lot of conversation lately. People who just want to go and buy a piece of land or just retire to the cabin, wherever it is they are, just to sort of settle in and contain. And I don't know what's going to come of that or if that's a movement afoot, but that's a crisis. Farming has been in crisis for some time, and it's largely due to corporations pushing them out.
Mm. The years 1910 to 1960, also a period of great upheaval, economic and political. Two world wars, Korea, the Great Depression, the Cold War, and as you put it, a burgeoning consumer culture. Can you give us some sense of how these events were experienced and or seen in rural America in these decades?
Well,
it's a big question, sorry.
That is a big question. Let me organize my thoughts here for a second. The reason I chose those 50 years is because there was so much turmoil, and it all directly played a role in this movement of population. I mean, World War I really saw young men leave the farms and go overseas, and that's no different than any other young men who is in the United States at the time, urban or rural. They went overseas. Their worlds were expanded. And they brought new techniques back with them. There was also a movement afoot in that time, the progressive movement, that also included a movement towards better farming methods. There was a movement towards more education for farmers in that period. There was, during the Great Depression, the need to turn to better farm methods because it was determined that a great deal of the Dust Bowl the dust storms and the drought, you know, could have been survived in some respects if the land had been better respected. So there was a sort of a changing of philosophy on the part of many farm families and many farmers in terms of what best suits the land, which I think was a good thing.
Yeah. The push for better methods and more education, what role did farm women play in that?
Farm women were at the front of that movement. When we look at the statistics, the literacy statistics from this period, comparing urban to rural women, we find that rural women were as literate, if not more so, than urban women. And we also find that rural women were more literate than rural men. And that is certainly borne out by a lot of the research that I conducted. It seems to me that farm women were the ones who were writing for farm publications. They're the ones who are pushing for better education for their children. They're the ones who are spearheading movements for safety on the farms. This is something I don't talk about a lot in the book, but it is something that they were very concerned about with these large pieces of machinery that are starting to come to the farms. It became a dangerous place for some small children to be if they weren't very carefully watched. In fact, it's still dangerous on farms if you're not careful with some of those big machines. And farm women were really at the front of those movements, and they were the ones who were writing about them and talking about them and trying to make changes.
Yeah. So they're providing editorial content, and they're talking to other farm women and no doubt farm men.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, yeah. And I would suspect that perhaps they weren't politically involved in terms of running for office, but participating in a political sense in other arenas that are public, but yet still maybe we could say within the realm of a woman, and that is women's clubs, churches, school activities, farm organizations. What's the story there?
Well, farm organizations were a place where women really were invited. It did take some effort on the part of women to get themselves invited in some cases. Laura Ingalls Wilder writes for the Missouri Ruralist in 1915. She talks about a meeting of a farm organization, a new farmers club that was going to get started. And her husband, whom she referred to as the man of the place in her ruralist articles, had gone, and she'd gone also, but she didn't see very many women there. And she wrote in her column that she thought perhaps that farm men needed to be, you know, told that farm women would enjoy being included too, and so let's all join the next meeting. So there was kind of this advocacy. Her story is she's not alone in this. There was kind of an advocacy on the part of farm women who wrote for these publications to bring farm women into farming organizations. And Mrs. Wilder is a very good example because she actually was a secretary for the agricultural club in their area, and she was a treasurer. And it was this is an example of the kind of involvement that farm women partook in. One of the things we have to consider is because their lives and their businesses were so closely tied to the piece of land that they lived on, it was challenging for them to go elsewhere to run for office. If you're going to run for a state office, you're going to run for a national office, you have to leave your farm. Mm. You have to leave your business. And that would have been really difficult for them to do.
What can you say about farm women at the outset of this period and their feelings about suffrage for women?
They were in favor of suffrage for women. And in fact, farm men were in favor of suffrage for women. This was one of my pleasant surprises when I was doing my research. I didn't realize myself that I had kind of internalized this idea that farm women wouldn't have been so active in the suffrage movement. But in fact, they were strong advocates for suffrage. And a farmer, the editor of the Wisconsin State Journal, actually, wrote that farm men needed to also stand up for their women in suffrage because those women were the ones who are making a lot of these decisions, and they should be included in the vote. They're included in family decisions. They usually decide what crops are going to go in. They make all of these business decisions. They need to have a voice in the public arena as well. They needed the vote. And that was uniform. It was almost not even contested. It was women need the vote.
Mm. Here's a question you pose early in your book, More Than a Farmer's Wife. How have farm women constructed their own identities as political beings and citizens? And to look at the question, you look at mass media. How important was the media to farm families? Were media to farm families?
It was critical. Again, we're looking at people who were tied to it one piece of land, when, especially early on in this period when travel was remarkably difficult. And you had, say, your closest town was 20 miles away. You weren't going into town to get your news, at least not often. And so you were dependent upon all of the media that you could get into your farmhouse. So the newspaper that would be delivered out maybe a day or two late, the magazines that you took that were delivered, your inner circles, your women's clubs and so forth, that was another part of this, certainly. But your media was what tied you not only to, you know, the real world or the world outside your farmhouse door, but also to the other people in your community. In a way, farming magazines and farming publications that came to the farmhouse really served as what we would think of today as internet bulletin boards, in which women could talk to each other by writing letters to the editor, having conversations in these publications, and also find out what was going on at the national and state and local levels in terms of farm regulations and pricing, which is a big concern of theirs at this time. So mass media was critical to their existence. It was the only way they'd be able to function as businesswomen.
Yeah. The magazines you read in your research were Country Gentleman, The Farmer's Wife, Farm Journal, Good Housekeeping, Ladies' Home Journal, and the Saturday Evening Post.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us something about the first three in the list, because I've never laid my eyes on these publications. I don't even know if these publications are still in publication. Country Gentleman, The Farmer's Wife, and Farm Journal.
Farm Journal is still in publication.
Okay.
I want to make that very clear.
Okay.
And in fact, the a recent editor of the Farm Journal, Sonia Hilgren, is a pioneer in farm journalism, and she unfortunately passed away two winters ago. But the Farm Journal itself is still in publication and is running in kind of a niche market now. They have tailored their publications to each region of the United States. It is still a national farming magazine tailored to the needs of the farmers it serves. Farmer's Wife was started in 1897 by Webb Publishing Company, and it was edited by the daughter of the original publisher. And it ran as its own publication until 1937, when it became kind of a casualty of the Great Depression and falling circulation rates, and it was merged with the Farm Journal, and it became a secondary magazine sort of folded into the back of the Farm Journal. Country Gentleman, and I'll come back to The Farmer's Wife because it's critical to this study. Country Gentleman was a national magazine also that drew a rural audience, more of an upper-class rural audience, I think, as I was reading it. That was what struck me. But it also fell kind of into some hard times during the Depression. It tried some interesting things with circulation, but in 1955, finally, it went under and folded into the Farm Journal also. So at the end of this period that I'm writing about, in 1960, all three of those magazines had become one magazine, the Farm Journal. All three of them were national publications aimed at a national farming audience.
And give us some idea now, if you would, about had we been reading Farmer's Wife in the years at the outset of the 20th century into well into the 1930s, what kinds of things would we find in that publication?
Well, when you open the pages of the Farmer's Wife magazine, the first thing that you're struck by is how vivid and exciting the writing is. Women were very excited to be a part of that publication, and they were very excited to be talking to each other through that magazine. The first two pages were editorials. There was quick news about happenings at the national level for farmers and farm women, and there were notes about education, they were very clear that women, farm women, were in charge of their children's education. So they had notes about education. They had notes about progress and farm progress and new farming methods. All of this was in the first few pages. And then they had advertising, of course, but it's not the kind of advertising we would see in ladies' housekeeping. It's not, for example, soap and ladies' products and clothing. It's things like cream separators and pullets, which are baby chickens, specially bred chickens. Different kinds of advertising than you would see in other women's magazines of the day. And you would see at least three columns in which women were able to write in and share their ideas about things. One in particular was run as a forum for women to sort of air their interests and complaints and questions and for other women to answer those questions. They're fascinating to read, and if you read them over succession of months, you can see that a question will be posed, let's say, in the January issue, and it will be answered in March, and then someone will counter that answer in April, and it's really fun. If you can read them just right in a row like that, it really reminds you of a bulletin board on the Internet.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yep. Tweets. Amy Mattson-Lauders is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of More Than a Farmer's Wife, Voices of American Farm Women, 1910 to 1960. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling locally from the University of Illinois Library, and I don't know if Professor Lauders was at the Agricultural History Society conference in Little Rock last week, but if not, that's where I launched our new repository of digitized farm newspapers, and it does include Farmer's Wife, so I thought you might want to know about it. It's going to make your research a lot easier. And
oh,
I thought maybe
goodness.
The general listing audience would be interested. This is a free repository of digitized facsimiles of the original farm newspapers. We were able to create this repository with a grant from the Illinois State Library through the Library Services and Technology Act, which is a federal program. And we digitized 100, it's actually about 115,000 pages of farm weeklies, from the last half of the 19th century up to the early part of the 20th century. And Prairie Farmer happens to go, or not Prairie Farmer, Farmer's Wife happens to go up to 1939. So it's not going to help you with the latter part of the period that you're interested in. But it does, as you know, these publications were never indexed, and they're very difficult to use. But now, with digital technology, they're keyword searchable and as well as browsable. So it really brings this material to a much broader audience, and it's such rich resource source material that it's a lot of fun for, I think, just about anybody to experiment with. Can I give you the URL for this?
Yes, please.
It's www.library.illinois.edu/ D as in dog, N as in newspaper, C as in collection, / FFF as in Frank. And that stands for Farm, Field, and Fireside, which is the name of the repository, and that's also the title of one of the publications that we're digitizing. We haven't loaded all of the content in so far. We just have four titles, The Farmer's Wife, Prairie Farmer, Farmer's Voice, a very interesting publication, and Berkshire World and Corn Belt Stockman, which, although devoted to Berkshire's swine, is actually a very interesting publication. And all of these publications, by the way, have features for women and children as well. So there's a lot of very rich material.
Yeah. The URL is very helpful. However, I would imagine, and we've got people in cars or whatever listening who might want to take a look at this and who can't write it down, is there a way just to go to the University of Illinois Library and find it in a search there?
Yes, you can do that.
Okay.
Just as Farm Field and Fireside.
Farm Field and Fireside.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, enjoy.
Okay.
Well, I know. I just jot that down. That's fabulous news.
Okay. Let's take another call, a listener in Lawrence County. Line 4, hi.
The previous caller mentioned one of the magazines that I wanted to add to your list, and that was Prairie Farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember reading that, I kind of read everything that came into the house. And besides Farm Journal, we also got Successful Farmer, which I don't remember being as interesting to me as the Prairie Farmer. And for one reason, it had a column by a woman named Delight Weir, W-E-I-R. Are you familiar with her or that column?
Yes, I've seen that column.
Okay, well, I thought of Prairie Farmer. When you mentioned Farm Journal, it kind of brought back some memories because we got all of those magazines and a very interesting show. So thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Thank you.
Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone on line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was just wondering whether you had any comparisons between the farm women and women who might have been intimately involved in other small businesses, whether they were rural or not. I'll hang up and listen.
That is a great question. And, in fact, I didn't do that kind of comparison for this book. But it's really clear in, for example, Saturday Evening Post, that they really did see farm women as business women, and they made conscious comparisons to women in small business in cities. Now, we're talking about a period where women going into business for themselves in the cities was not something that happened very frequently. And the businesses that women did run in the cities tended to be things like dressmaking or temporary agencies, this kind of thing. We're still really looking at women's labor history that way, but I will say that the two most recent scholarly efforts to look at women's labor history, both by Alice Kessler Harris, they don't mention farm women at all. So there's a gap there, and that's one of the things that this book is trying to address a little bit.
Yeah. Boy, how great, though, to be in this scholarly endeavor at this time, because you've got so much richness.
Oh, yes.
So much there to mine. And we know that women's studies as a discipline is relatively young.
Yeah.
But still, it seems that the lack of scholarship about farm women is a little surprising, that it's so absent. Why the lack of scholarship?
Well, there is some out there, but it's sort of disparate. And there's a Rural Women's Association, and there's a Rural Women's Scholarship Association I've just learned about in the last couple of years, where there is some effort being made to do this history. But I think that one of the problems we face is that so many women who are interested or even could be interested in this line of scholarship don't necessarily want to look back at the farm. It's the same kind of pain, really, that children and grandchildren of farmers feel when they look back at this place where they left because they couldn't get the opportunities that they wanted. Those who left because they wanted an education or they wanted what they perceived to be a better way of life in the city. So there's this element of, I guess pain is the best word that I can come up with.
Okay. Let's take one more call, and we'll have to be quick. Line 1, Vermilion. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to let you all know that in farm tractor owner's manuals, even as far back as 1950, they have a section in safety which refers to women operating the tractors should wear trousers and not skirts. So even in that era, farm businesses recognized that women were, in fact, operating the farms.
Yes, and that is one of the best things that I have found about so much of this advertising is that it really explicitly addresses women's needs on the farms and need to wear trousers when you're on the tractor. It makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I thank you for that observation because that's a good one.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're right here at the end of time. Real quick about radio.
Radio was just coming in in the 30s and 40s and 50s on the farms. And it was funny because they loved having the radio on, but in order to make it work, they had to have batteries. And one woman in particular, Phyllis Spade, told me about having to take the great big car battery, but I kind of envision it as a car battery, into town every Saturday to charge it up so they could listen to the radio during the week. But
many,
also a very critical part of their life.
Yeah, many interesting stories here. Amy Mattson-Lauders, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Amy Lauders is the author of More Than a Farmer's Wife, Voices of American Farm Women, 1910 to 1960. The book is published by the University of Missouri Press.